from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, we're going to break down the results of yesterday's New Hampshire primary. It was a big night for Democrat Bernie Sanders and Republican Donald Trump, who both won with double-digit leads over their opponents.
We have sent the message that will echo from Wall Street to Washington, from Maine to California.
We are going to make America great again.
Coming up, we get expert analysis of winners and losers and what it all means as South Carolina and Nevada are up ahead. Join us and join in after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Democratic Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Republican real estate developer Donald Trump both won decisive victories last night in New Hampshire. The Granite State primary had a record-breaking voter turnout for the state primary and was the first presidential primary in the nation, following on the heels of last week's Iowa caucuses. In this morning's opening Forum Hour, we want to look at yesterday's results and what they mean about the race for the American presidency and talk about what comes up ahead. Let me tell you who is joining us. We want to welcome, first of all, here in studio, senior political writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, Joe Garofoli. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Good to have you, Joe. And also good to have Katrina Vandenhoven with us again, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. And welcome, Katrina.
Thank you, Michael.
And we should mention that The Nation has endorsed Bernie Sanders. It's the only presidential endorsement that they have made other than, well, Jesse Jackson and Barack Obama. And let's talk about this and what it means, not only in light of your endorsement, Katrina, but also the fact that I guess I would phrase this that now we've been hearing a lot from the GOP in the debate about Hillary and she being the presumptive candidate. I guess we've crossed the threshold now. Maybe they're going to have to talk about Bernie, aren't they?
Michael, let me just reset the good opening. The Nation, this is the third time in a presidential primary. We endorsed Jesse Jackson. We endorsed Obama. We've been around so long that we endorsed in a presidential primary, we endorsed Ulysses Grant.
Wow.
That said, I think it's hard to overstate what Bernie Sanders has already achieved in this campaign. And in spite of the obstacles he's had to surmount in order to achieve it, I'd argue that he has reset the terms of the debate. I think you saw that in New Hampshire last night. It's both the mood in this country, the economics for millions of Americans, but the issues that move people are the issues Bernie Sanders has put squarely on the agenda. Inequality, a rigged system that works on behalf of the very wealthy, those were takeaways from exit polls. So I think it's also the sense that he's an authentic, honest, trustworthy, uncorrupted messenger, not mortgaged to big corporate money, that he's running a campaign independent of that money that frees him to tell some pretty harsh truths about the corruption of our politics and economy. I'd say one last thing. There's a kind of mild dissing of young people because coming out of Iowa, where Bernie Sanders won 84% of the youth vote, that, you know, young people are in it for the purity. They don't get it. They're not pragmatic or savvy. Well, last night I think that was shattered in the sense that you had almost every demographic voting for Bernie Sanders, including, very importantly, independents, who broke, I think, 7-10 for him, and the working class. But that said, The Nation is not a monolith. Our inimitable columnist, Katha Pollitt, our national affairs correspondent, Joan Walsh, have made their strong cases for why they believe Hillary Clinton is the candidate for these times. And I think it's a fascinating moment, Michael, for the Democratic Party to think seriously about what kind of party it's going to be, what's going to emerge from this primary, and what are the strategies and theories for change in these tumultuous times where people seem to be demanding something more than the usual kind of incremental, will help you along, but not enough fundamental transformative change people seeking in their lives of all ages and places.
Well, to the points you make, there was a poll on honesty and trustworthiness. It ran 91% in favor of Bernie Sanders to the 5% of Hillary Clinton, and he really dominated in every field except for older people over 65 and with a income of over $100,000, which I suppose speaks volumes as well. Clinton campaign, as you kind of intimated, seemed to say maybe the youth vote is a little bit too at the windmills and all of that sort of thing. But they also said that he's maybe a one-trick pony. He's got income inequality, and that's what he's mainly been presenting as the major issue. And there was a piece which perhaps you saw in the New York Times that said that he doesn't really come out strongly when it comes to foreign affairs. He sort of avoids questions on North Korea, Afghanistan specifically. And, you know, his strength is appealing to people who are concerned about this income inequality mainly.
Well, first of all, Michael, I wrote a column for The Washington Post yesterday. I write a weekly column for TheWashingtonPost.com. It was Sanders should challenge the foreign policy status quo. And as we wrote in our nation endorsement, we haven't heard enough from the senator on the fundamental international issues. Yet, he has carved out some distinctions when he's spoken about foreign policy. Clinton promises a continuation of current policy with more hawkish interventionist thrusts. She's supported a regime change policy in Libya. She's for a no-fly zone in Syria. She's basically for policing the world in ways Bernie Sanders really has challenged. He's also much more about what President Obama spoke of in the 2008 campaign when Clinton derided Obama. Bernie Sanders wants to open up a broader relationship with Iran. Secretary of State Clinton supported the nuke deal with Iran, but she's, you know, now very much about putting more sanctions on them and not moving forward to open up a broader relationship that would enable a better American engagement in the region. So I think that Bernie Sanders may well make a major foreign policy speech soon. I think he has in his record the ability to speak about a rigged economy at home, Michael, which, by the way, is not just inequality. It really fundamentally defines the power relations of our country. But extrapolate from that rigged economy at home to a rigged economy globally, I think is a very powerful message. I also finally think climate change, which is often derided by some as saying that's not national security. Well, the Pentagon sure as hell thought it was when they issued a report a few years ago saying climate change was one of the great security challenges. And underreported is what's going on with Russia. I mean, the United States, NATO, has just quadrupled spending on putting weapons and material on Russia's border, unprecedented since the German invasion of the Soviet Union, that we are that close to their borders. And Secretary of State Clinton has been a cold warrior in ways Bernie Sanders, I think, is trying to suggest we would do better to have a coalition with Russia on certain issues like ending the Syrian conflict, nuclear proliferation issues, and combating terrorism. So I think that there are some real differences. Senator Sanders needs to speak up because it becomes a test, yes, of his electability. It's not just he's not speaking out on foreign policy. It's a broader framework that he needs to speak to if he wants to be considered seriously, as many thousands of people are suggesting they're ready to consider him seriously for president.
Again, Katrina Vandenhuvel is with us by phone. She's editor and publisher of the National Magazine. They have endorsed Bernie Sanders. And as I said, Joe Garofoli here in studio, senior political writer with the San Francisco Chronicle. And just politically, he's going to meet with Al Sharpton today. That is Bernie Sanders. I want to talk with you, Joe, about the Republican race. And we're also going to get Matthew Conanetti in here from the Washington Free Beacon and the Weekly Standard. But how much really African-American support and, for that matter, evangelical support can he garner in South Carolina? And I'm specifically talking about the fact that evangelicals certainly – I don't know. Are they supporting Hillary Clinton who are they supporting?
Well, right now African-Americans are supporting Clinton 60%. I believe one of the figures I've seen is. And that's largely based on their history with Bill Clinton, a son of the South and someone who talked about his own version of economic inequality back
first
in the
black
day.
President, according to Toni Morrison.
Exactly, right? Exactly. So, but at the same time, now Sanders is pushing back. Well, Bill Clinton, you pushed the crime bill too. That kind of set off this mass incarceration of African Americans. you're going to hear Sanders push back on Clinton on those things, which we haven't heard much about. It's almost been taken for granted that Clinton gets the black vote. Among Latinos, I think that's going to be a harder sell for Sanders. I don't know. Nevada is going to be a very, very interesting test case on that. That's the first contest in the West, and it's coming up in, in about a week or so. And we're going to see how well he can make inroads in the Latino community there.
Let's talk about the Republican race, and I said we're going to get Matthew Continetti on with us, too. But from your perspective, Joe, it's muddled. I mean, if anything, the waters are even more muddy than they were before. But things are kind of moving more toward Trump in the sense that there's all these splits. Kasich has to go now to South Carolina, where he has very little money or infrastructure. And as you point out in an article that you wrote, at this point, he looks like Huntsman. He looks like John Huntsman did.
He got basically Kasich got basically the same percentage of vote in New Hampshire as Huntsman did. And he faces much the same struggle. He banked everything on New Hampshire. He was there for 110 house parties. He was there for 70 days, more than anybody else. And, you know, it was a make or break thing. He made it. Now what? He's polling about 2% in South Carolina, heavily evangelical electorate down there, I guess about 60%. And now this is all good news for Trump. As long as Trump is facing four people who are trying to split the quote-unquote mainstream Republican vote, that's good news for him. He can still sit at 35%, which is what he got in New Hampshire, and he can, you know, keep the Trump train will keep going.
There are some who feel that maybe New Hampshire shows Jeb Bush still has life in him, but on the other hand, Chris Christie doesn't. Chris Christie turned out to be maybe a kind of quasi-executioner of Marco Rubio, at least where New Hampshire is concerned, but he's going home to New Jersey to consider whether he ought to stay in the race.
I think by the time the show's over today, Michael, Chris Christie will no longer be a candidate. When someone's going home to consider their options, that usually means there's only one option.
And again, Joe Garofoli is senior political writer with the San Francisco Chronicle. Matthew Continetti is editor of the Washington Free Beacon, contributing editor of the Weekly Standard. And Matthew, let me welcome you to the program. Good morning to you.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And I want to hear kind of another view from you, which is essentially that you still feel that, I believe you still feel that Secretary Clinton is the presumptive candidate.
Well, I think in the long run, she has a good chance to defeat Bernie Sanders, but I don't think it's by any means guaranteed. I mean, my takeaway from New Hampshire is that we're experiencing a political earthquake, a populist earthquake in both parties. And when you look at Trump and Sanders, and in many ways, their messages are similar. They're saying the game is rigged. They're against money in politics. They're against trade deals. They're against corporations and corporate power. They differ on immigration, but really, otherwise, their message is the same, including on health care.
But your argument, I believe, is that Sanders is going to be useful to conservatives. Isn't pretty much that your position?
Well, I do think so, because I believe he's exposed a mass reluctance on the part of Democrats to have Hillary Clinton as their nominee. When you consider all of her experience, the fact that she's been in public life for 3 decades now, her reputation, the fact that she's backed by most of her party's establishment, to basically tie Iowa and then lose New Hampshire by this historic margin, I think is a sign of no confidence on the part of the Democratic base.
Let me get your sense of what you think is going to happen in South Carolina, particularly where the Republicans are concerned. Possibility of a second act for Rubio, I guess, is one of the big questions. But the other one is whether Donald Trump, with the kind of big rallies and media coverage that he has been doing, as opposed to the sort of thing that Kasich did, for example, in New Hampshire, or for that matter, we saw Bernie Sanders doing in Iowa. How is that going to play out in your judgment? I mean, it's certainly going to be very different than what we saw in New Hampshire and Iowa.
Well, I think the biggest question I have going into South Carolina is with the third place finisher in New Hampshire, Ted Cruz, who won Iowa, and is really the candidate now of very conservative evangelical voters who play an enormous role in the Republican Party. You have to remember, Ted Cruz did not campaign against Donald Trump in New Hampshire. He wanted Donald Trump to win New Hampshire so as to block the somewhat conservative candidates or the candidates like Marco Rubio, who draws support from so-called somewhat conservative voters, Jeb Bush, John Kasich draws support from moderates. Well, Donald Trump won New Hampshire. And so now what you're going to see, and you're already seeing it in some of these ads, is Ted Cruz resuming his campaign against Donald Trump. And if Ted Cruz can pull out a victory in South Carolina, I think we really have a two-man race for the Republican nomination between Cruz and Donald Trump.
But that gets right to the point. I mean, Donald Trump's form of campaigning is almost the antithesis of Ted Cruz's, as we saw Ted Cruz operating on the ground in Iowa. And as I said, Trump coming in for appearances and flying in with his jet with the Trump label on it and so forth. South Carolina is probably as likely to be more hospitable to those who go to the town hall meetings like we saw in New Hampshire. And Iowa.
Right. What did Trump say in his victory speech? He said, "We learned a whole lot about the ground game in the past week." Donald Trump has not been paying much attention to the traditions of political campaigning before his loss to Ted Cruz in Iowa. I think if he wants to win South Carolina, which he has a chance of doing, he's really going to have to put a lot of grunt work and organization into his campaign. You know, the fascinating thing about Donald Trump is he's winning. Really getting a plurality of these somewhat conservative voters who have determined the nominee in the past several open Republican primaries. He's also getting a plurality, we shouldn't forget, of Republicans who identify as moderates. And so those two groups tend to determine the nominee. And I think that's something that the other candidates who are vying for those votes have to reckon with. They're by splitting that vote, they are leaving the party open to nominating Donald Trump and to nominating Cruz, who has really consolidating his group of voters who are very conservative evangelicals.
Let's get Katrina Vandenhoevel's take on that race between Cruz and Trump. At this point, Trump is starting to give a different persona to us. It seems like he's trying to act like a statesman a little bit, Katrina. I don't know if you can bring that
up. let me step back. First of all, would never imagine one would feel sorry for GOP establishment donors. The big donors are in a fix. They don't know where to move, what to do with the big money they want to invest in the politics. But picking up, I think, on what Matthew said, it seems to be very rarely in modern history has the populism of the left and the right flourished concurrently. And though I see in Donald Trump a right-wing populism, which is about turning on others, scapegoating. Bernie Sanders is about turning to others in solidarity. I do think that the establishment, biggest losers last night, and 2016 will be remembered no matter what happens as the year that saw a ground-altering, assumptions-undermining earthquake in American politics with aftershocks, good and not so good, that will surely be felt for many decades to come. But I do think we left New Hampshire last night. It's very muddled. I think you saw Trump, you know, his strength is not policy. He's essentially running the spectrum in a kind of cafeteria-style politics where people pick and choose. The exit polls, as I read them, show there was big support in New Hampshire for some of what I think are Trump's truly demagogic, ugly policies on immigration, on Muslims. But there's also the inequality factor. I mean, Donald Trump, like Bernie Sanders, appeals to a working class which feels it has been left behind, whose wages have been stagnant for 30, 40 years. And though I think Republicans have no answers,
Katrina, he's also saying, like Bernie Sanders, I'm not taking PAC money.
Yeah, but, you know, the idea that billionaires are going to define how we run a campaign system, I'm for empowering all kinds of people around this country who want to run. What kind of statement is it to millions of Americans, you can only run if you're a billionaire and you can self-fund? I think what Bernie Sanders is showing is the power of that $27 donation, allowing a new model of running in this country, freed from what I'd call the kind of industrial consultant class. But I did want to say, heading to South Carolina, it's going to be important for Donald Trump, yes. But I think we're overstating the lock the Clintons have on African-American voters in South Carolina. You know, we have a piece just up on our site, thenation.com, this morning by Michelle Alexander, the author of The New Jim Crow, which really does lay out the history of Bill Clinton, though Hillary Clinton played a central role in his administration, in capitulating to the right-wing backlash against the civil rights movement in that time and embracing a Reagan-esque agenda on race, crime, certainly welfare, doing harm to black communities. And I think a younger generation of black and, yes, Latino voters outside of the perceived mainstream in their communities, looking hard, looking at, you know, these two candidates and trying to understand maybe this resurgent economic populism is tied closely to the newly energized racial justice movement. So I think Secretary of State Clinton certainly has a leading edge heading into South Carolina. But I think Bernie Sanders is going to rise in the ultimate vote. And in losing, you know, Bernie Sanders may kind of win in a way as he heads into Nevada, which, by the way, has strong labor movement tradition, and some key labor unions there have endorsed Bernie Sanders.
Well, there's another element to this, though, and I'd like to go to you on this, Matthew Continetti, and that is the superdelegates. The count from the Associated Press says that at present, Secretary Clinton has a pretty commanding delegate lead, about 352 in the race for the 2,382 that are needed to win the nomination. We've been getting emails all morning about the delegate count in New Hampshire versus the vote that went for Bernie Sanders.
And I think those types of stories, I mean, well, first, we're talking about superdelegates, so, I mean, I'm experiencing a 2008 flashback already.
Yeah.
But, you know, those stories about Hillary tying in Iowa and losing by an historic margin in New Hampshire, yet having more delegates than Bernie, those stories are sure to inflame Bernie supporters. I mean, just to show them that Bernie's critique of the Democratic Party is basically being out of touch and more or less a rigged game. I mean, that's going to, I think, if anything, motivate them to support him. I agree with Katrina that these races in Nevada and South Carolina are going to become much more competitive as a result of New Hampshire. You saw in national polls released in between Iowa and New Hampshire that Bernie was closing the gap with Hillary Clinton. And that's going to happen now. I mean, you can't have a primary where the former First Lady and Secretary of State to the sitting president loses by 21 points and not think that the rest of the campaign is going to tighten as well.
Again, Matthew Continetti is editor of the Washington Post, Washington Free Beacon.
One day.
Are you endorsing, by the way, Matthew?
No, we're neutral in this race.
Okay, and contributing editor of Weekly Standard, are they endorsing?
No, I don't believe that the Standard endorses either.
All right. I know we have to say goodbye to you, and I thank you for being with us. We're going to actually have David Frum on us with the second half hour, former speechwriter for George W. Bush, who, by the way, is going to South Carolina to campaign for his brother. I don't know if Barbara Bush is going to be there. If she campaigns, of course, Trump will talk about Jeb Bush bringing his mommy. But David Frum will join us. He's senior editor of The Atlantic after we have a brief break here. And I'd like to take this opportunity to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. You can do that by calling us at our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free, you can join us now at 866-733-6786, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page. Lots of ways to join the program. We invite you to do so. Joe Garofoli, senior political writer of the San Francisco Chronicle with us. Katrina Vandenhovel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, which has endorsed Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. When we return, we hear from you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. It was a big night for Democratic Bernie Sanders and Republican Donald Trump, who both won the double-digit leads over their opponents in New Hampshire. We're discussing the results. We're breaking down, actually, the results of the primary in New Hampshire and discussing what they mean for upcoming events. We spoke earlier with Matthew Continetti, editor of the Washington Free Beacon and contributing editor of the Weekly Standard, and Katrina Vandenhovel is with us for the hour, editor and publisher of The Nation. They have endorsed Senator Bernie Sanders. Joe Garofoli is here in studio, senior political writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. And we're going to go to your calls and emails. Again, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. We challenged, actually, listeners on social media to share their reactions to the New Hampshire results in four words. Let me just read some of the responses. Pete writes, times be a-changing. Lisa writes, farewell establishment, good riddance. Chris tweets, pretty good. That's from LaPorte.
Very, very nice. Curb Your Enthusiasm reference.
That's exactly right. And Jen says, women voted for Bernie, followed by an exclamation mark. Let me read some other social media comments. Harry tweets this take on the New Hampshire results. Trump and Sanders solidify lead. Kasich amazes. Rubio now thought of as a robot unelectable. Another tweet from Lisa. I'm moving to Italy if either of the New Hampshire primary winners is elected. Steve says on Facebook, I love it. I want Bernie to be president. I think he's still got an uphill battle, though, and he's probably going to lose in South Carolina. And another comment from on our Facebook page about the superdelegates. Look at the delegate counts. Because of superdelegates, Hillary Clinton got more in New Hampshire than Bernie and has many more committed. So we will go to your calls here. Let me first go to Joe Garofoli, though, who again is here with us in studio. And a lot of people are making a good deal or trying to make a good deal out of the fact that there's maybe a pattern to be gleaned out of New Hampshire, because you had Reagan in 1980, you had Bush 1 in 88, and McCain in 2008, and then, of course, Romney in 2012. But doesn't quite pan out.
Well, yeah. I mean, I agree with what Katrina's saying, and this was a mind-blowing moment and for the statement that the voters there made, that they're frustrated with the system and the politics and the way we do business now. But at the same time, this New Hampshire also gave us winners like Pat Buchanan and Paul Tsongas and Gary Hart. And so it's not necessarily an accurate indicator of who will be our next president.
So how much does New Hampshire really matter, you think?
I think it matters in that face-to-face contact. It definitely does. You can't get that in many other states. But again, that's part of the reason we should sort of use an asterisk here, because people have been camping out there for a year. This is also a state that's 98% white. And they can have independents, can vote either in Republican or Democratic, as Republicans or Democrats. So there's sort of an ebb and flow that you don't get in other strict primary states. So there are some caveats to these victories tonight.
Well, let me bring in our listeners and we go right to your calls. We'll go first to you, Ken. You're on. Good morning.
Thank you. One is that I'm a white guy. I'm over 65 and into my 70s. I'm a Bernie supporter. My income is above $100,000. My kids, who are much less in that area, also support Bernie. But the interesting thing is, I think he's going to start attracting evangelicals. He's a guy who was a carpenter, came up from the ranks as a populist from the day he hit the street as a young kid, all the way up through both in Burlington, where he really changed the city around, and then went into Congress and then the Senate. And he wants to do something that's very interesting. He wants to throw the money changers out of politics, somewhat similar to a guy who did that 2,000 years ago. He has that undercurrent, and I've seen it in some places that I wouldn't necessarily have noticed. And I'd like to hear a comment on that one.
All right.
Bernie's the new Jesus.
Well, you know, it's funny because when I have to say this on record, when I interviewed him, I said, what do you think is a bigger handicap or albatross for you, being Jewish or being a socialist? And he answered me very directly, and he said, I think being a socialist, but I'm a democratic socialist, you know. and then somebody said, well, maybe he should run for president of Sweden. You know, some wag pointed that out. But how much, Katrina, do you think that the socialism albatross is really going to hurt him?
Bernie Sanders or anyone is a political messiah is Jesus. They're politicians. Some are more, you know, upright than others. But I do think your caller deserves an answer. I do think that in the faith community, certainly a younger generation in the faith community, for example, on issues like climate, is more open, is not as locked in to a kind of Cruz coalition of evangelicals. And I think there's a man in North Carolina, Reverend William Barber, who runs something called the Moral Mondays movement, which is about many things, including securing voting rights, who keeps saying, we need a moral politics, not this left-right. Left-right, when did working people's rights, when did voting rights, women's rights become left-right issues? We need to speak in a different language. He doesn't even allow the term right-left because he says right is from a different era. On socialism, Michael, I think Bernie Sanders is essentially a social democrat. He is an unreconstructed New Dealer of the 21st century. A lot of people have been looking beyond the label. And not just young people, whose experience has been defined by growing up in a world post Wall Street crash. So they're more open in some ways. They may not know what democratic socialism means, and I say that with humility, not anything else, but they sure as hell know what unbridled capitalism is.
Yeah,
and
but the polls, I'm sorry,
and,
but
and Obama,
the polls
the
are still polls are still showing that Americans are more afraid of socialism.
You know what, Michael? Polls, schmoles. I'm serious. I mean, what we've seen in this campaign, and I do think New Hampshire is a big deal in the sense that it was a big deal for the Clintons over the decades, but I think we've seen Bernie Sanders, despite schmoles polls and media malpractice, as I call it, the ability to go from 3% 9 months ago to where he is today, despite a press that at first dismissed him as marginal, as lefty, as a wild-eyed socialist, and giving Donald Trump, did people see this? The Tyndall Report, very well respected. In 2015, ABC News devoted 261 minutes to the 2016 campaign. Donald Trump got 81 minutes. Bernie Sanders got 20 seconds. So I think you're looking at a rigged system, media, polling, money. And Bernie Sanders, you know, who knows? I do think the term is a tough one still in this country for older generation. I don't think a younger generation is as tied up in knots about what democratic socialism means.
Well, I mentioned that we would bring David Frumman to this discussion. He's senior editor of The Atlantic, former speechwriter for George W. Bush, and his piece, The Great Republican Revolt, actually appeared in the 2016 edition of The Atlantic, in January edition. David Frumman, good to have you with us on Forum. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I guess let's begin with what your take is on New Hampshire. You say democracy won in New Hampshire.
Yeah, this was supposed to be a dynastic succession this year, that there are two of the most famous names in American politics, each backed with vast amounts of money, and everything was smoothed for them by their respective party organizations. After the 2012 defeat, the Republican National Committee wrote a postmortem that was more or less a prescription for a Jeb Bush candidacy. And of course, the fix has profoundly been in for Hillary Clinton inside the Democratic Party, so much so that the vice president of the United States had to surrender his plans to run to succeed the president of the United States because the Democratic Party was so wired for Hillary Clinton. In New Hampshire, we saw an eruption. We've seen it all through the past year, but now it has become visible, now it's become countable, now it's measurable of how much of an eruption there is. How long it will continue? Stuart Stevens, the campaign manager for Romney in 2012, has this wonderful line, the casino doesn't always win, but that's the way to bet.
Yeah, I was struck by that remark of Stevens that appears in your article. I was also struck when you were talking about how there's been a kind of seismic shift in terms of Republicans, and we're talking about rank-and-file Republicans who want you called it the return of the repressed. I was impressed if you remember of that. But they want Social Security medical benefits. They want health care. They want all the kinds of things that essentially they feel they can get from a non-establishment candidate.
Look, most people aren't very ideological, and that's a healthy thing because most of what we call ideology is pretty arbitrary, actually. So, those of us who are politically active and have well-developed political opinions, which we share with our friends and neighbors, whether they like it or not, we think, I think this about abortion. And so necessarily I must think that about guns. And of course it follows that I think this third thing about the corporate tax rate, and this is what I think about Iran, and it all comes together like a daisy chain. But that's a construct, and it's usually something that somebody else invented for us. And people who are less invested in politics may say, you know what, I'm able to think as you do about abortion or guns or whatever it may be, and I don't have to follow you when you think about these other things. And rank and file Republicans, this has been the great discovery of 2016, that the construct of ideology that has shaped the Congressional Republican Party, it's pretty unimpressive to most of the people who do the voting that keeps Republicans in power.
Joe Garofoli, yeah. Wanted in here.
And the other thing that's kind of unimpressive to voters, I think, so far is David referred to the dynastic candidacies here of Bush and Clinton. And they're using almost the same language at this point. They're saying, I hear your anger. I understand your anger. And here's what I'm going to do to fix it. they're offering sort of incremental changes. They're not offering these sort of
– Look at my website and the policy plans.
Exactly. What's – Trump doesn't have a policy plan. He says, I'm going to do it. We're going to have the best. I'm going to be the best jobs president. It's me, me, me. He's running almost
for
king.
We're going to be great. We're going to be happy.
Exactly. It's but there's no plans. Zero. And the one plan, his tax plan, has been panned as a mess.
Let me bring some more callers in here. I want to go to Pueblo, Colorado. And Brian, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I was struck as I was listening that the degree of agreement between the editors from The Nation and the Weekly Standard was just, you know, it tickled me to death, frankly. And if it can happen on the forum, maybe we can see this in Congress again someday. But the other thing that jumped out at me was Senator Sanders and Donald Trump have both really, you know, tapped into discontent that comes from three decades of wage stagnation, of outright purchase of our elected officials. And I think those things translate. We're worrying about Senator Sanders picking up votes from Latinos and other people of color, but those issues of social justice, those inequality issues, affect, you know, people in the, you know, people of color just as strongly as they do Anglos. And I think the next couple of weeks will prove interesting.
Indeed. And Brian, thank you for that call. Appreciate hearing from you. I want to read some emails now from listeners. Listener writes, I think the reason many older committed progressives support Hillary is not because we are moderate, but because we gave our hearts to McGovern and Mondale and we got Nixon and Reagan. Voting with your heart feels great for a few months. Voting with your head makes better policy for years. Ben writes, lately, I have seen more attack ads against Sanders addressing his history on the Veterans Committee. Even the New York Times ran an article. Is this something Sanders should worry about? What do you think, Katrina Vandenhoven?
Well, first of all, The Nation did not endorse Bernie Sanders because of his emotional appeal, but it was his clear-sightedness as a Tribune on core issues of our time that led us to make our only third presidential endorsement in a primary. And I wrote a column called Bernie Sanders is the realist we should elect. I think the new realism, Michael, put aside head, heart, the new realism is looking out at the country we live in and understanding that if one seeks change, fundamental, on-the-road change, you got to dismantle this rigged system. Bernie Sanders and the use of revolution, by the way, is another kind of thing I take issue with. I think what he's really talking about is a movement to take back power in this country, mobilizing a broad majority of people. You know, President Obama ran a campaign that was about mobilizing, yes, we can, all power to him. What happened at the end of that campaign, and some may disagree, is he went inside the Beltway, went inside the White House, and essentially demobilized Organizing for America. I think these are times where you need wind at the back. You need a very coherent strategy for change inside, outside. The famous example of LBJ, Voting Rights Act, you needed him as president. You needed Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement to drive it. So I think that's a very important lesson. As to where we are at this time.
Since you bring up the Civil Rights Movement, I'm looking at a tweet here, and Joe Garofoli, let me go to you on this. It's an interesting point from Carl, one of our listeners, who said, Black Americans liked Bill. He was better than 8 years of Reagan and 4 years of H.W. Bush, but no particular warm fuzzies for Hillary. And yet Hillary is pretty much the candidate, certainly in South Carolina, as you said earlier, of the majority and the preponderant number of Black Americans.
Well, we also have to remember that Hillary has only been a political candidate since 2000. I mean, she's only been in elected office since then. She was, you know, she was part of the office. She was sort of a backstage player, a grand at the front of the backstage. But she is an inexperienced candidate. You know, she hasn't establish those own relationships, I think. So it'll be curious to see if she can actually carry on which way she departs from her husband and which way she stays with him.
Well, the listener talks about warm fuzzies. There is the charisma factor. I mean, somehow
100%, yes.
Bill Clinton, many people have commented on this before, is just a superb campaigner. And it's not, yes, to say that she isn't. She's very ardent and very dedicated campaigner, to put it mildly. But that magic factor, whatever you want to call it. In fact, I'm looking at an email here from another listener, David, who says, Hillary, and this has come up before, of course, Hillary logged more miles than anyone else as Secretary of State and has the least to show for it. Most people cannot identify a single significant achievement she made in her years as Secretary of State. And let me go back to you, if I may, David, from and get a response from a listener named Dan, who says Democrats have been bemoaning Trump's frontrunner status from the beginning. Why? Isn't this the guy we want to be number one for the GOP? Correct me if I'm wrong, but he doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell of winning a general election against Sanders or Clinton. Run, Trump, run.
Well, I'm not a Democrat, so I can't enter into the emotional spirit of that note.
I understand. But what about the notion that Trump is good for the Democrats if he's the candidate?
I wouldn't be so sure. Trump is the most unpredictable, unfactorable. I think with most of the candidates, we have a pretty good idea of how they'll do and of what will happen and what won't happen. So I think we have a pretty good idea of how limited Bernie Sanders' appeal will be. I think we have a pretty fair idea of the strengths and weaknesses of Clinton appeal. And on the Republican side, we can make some pretty, I think, accurate comments about what's likely to happen with a Ted Cruz or a Marco Rubio or a Jeb Bush. With Donald Trump, one doesn't know. It could be a tremendous fiasco. But he also has space. Remember, precisely because he's not committed to much, he has space to pivot, for example, to a health care answer that is much more electable than the answer of the rest of the Republican Party. Most Republicans are committed to a health care policy that would withdraw health care coverage from millions, possibly tens of millions of people. Donald Trump is not. He could say anything. Now, it might not make any sense, but he could say anything. And he can say a lot on Medicare and Social Security that is unavailable for other Republicans to say.
Well, I've got a listener who says, and I don't know if this is answerable by you or anybody else, David, from, but says, will Trump try to overturn the Citizens United decision? Will he put environment above big corporations? He's unpredictable, so who knows, right?
Well, first, I have no idea. And second, of course, the Supreme Court would have to overturn the Citizens United decision. It wouldn't be up to Donald Trump. What we are seeing,
He could get some legislation going, I suppose, if he wanted to cross the aisle.
No, we couldn't. Citizens United interprets
Citizens the United has to be overturned by the Supreme Court, but I mean other type of legislation, yeah.
But here's what is happening that is so interesting, and this is the point of the article I posted on the Atlantic site this morning, that I think what we're seeing in the energy behind the Sanders and Trump campaign is the society rejecting the power of organized wealth that has been brought to bear for the Clintons, for Jeb Bush, and latterly for Marco Rubio.
We'll go to more of your calls. Let's bring in TJ. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I don't want to hijack this necessarily. I just wanted to make mention of it's Katrina Vanderhoevel said that there's this person with this moral Mondays and saying things that I agree are moral, but I think the left-right dichotomy provides a room for discussion and consensus, whereas if you say this is the moral stuff, what's the converse? It's immoral. So how can you say there's the moral and you're immoral if you oppose what I'm saying? That doesn't seem like it builds consensus or a good feeling on either side. Just wanted to say that. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, and I thank you for it. One wonders how much morality is going to figure into this campaign. It already has in many ways, of course. I'm looking at a website comment from a listener named Kevin who says, I like Hillary a lot and I support her, but my head tells me the best outcome would be a Democratic loss in 2016, very likely if Bernie is the nominee, quite possible if she is, which would lead to 4 years of horrible Republican misgovernment leading to a landslide for Elizabeth Warren and Democratic redistricting in 2020. Thoughts on that scenario, Joe?
I don't know if I ever want to vote bank on a scenario like that, the 4 years of bad news for my country.
Listener,
I think it's a terrible approach. I mean, millions of people's lives will be damaged and ravaged.
Yeah.
Homes lost, people evicted, kids, losing opportunities, end of all, a tax code that will become totally written for the very wealthiest. So I think, with all due respect to that caller, it's a little too strategic for me. I will say one thing about Hillary Clinton, though. First of all, with all due respect, I think it was David who talked about dynastic and end to dynastic politics. Fair. But I've always argued that, the Bushes are a dynasty, even the Pauls, Ron and Rand. I mean, the Clintons are a political marriage, in essence, and I don't think it's fair to Hillary Clinton, who's fought hard, though I disagree with some of her policies, to be a woman in politics at this time, possibly the first woman president. I would also say that though Bill Clinton did preside, as Michelle Alexander at TheNation.com writes, over a politics that really did damage to the African-American community. Because of the movements of our time, we're living in a movement moment, Black Lives Matter, racial justice movements, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have both put forward very powerful racial justice platforms and have really stepped back from what the Democratic Party stood for in passing that very damaging regressive crime bill of 1996, which was passed by Bill Clinton with Democratic support.
Let me go to Queens, New York, and welcome another caller. John, you're on. Good morning. John, are you there?
Yes, hello. This is Tom.
Oh, Tom, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's no problem. I'm just wondering, given this across-the-board revolt, how much of it is due to the fact that the voters are so frustrated by politicians and, you know, leading politicians saying, do as I say and not as I do, specifically looking at policies, for example, the intent to reset foreign policy with Iran and with the Russians, total debacle as far as most Americans can see on a practical day-to-day level. And same thing in terms of local policy, meaning domestic politics, where there's constant rhetoric against Wall Street, including on the part of mainly the Democratic Party across the board. And yet at the same time, it's the same Democratic presidency and Congress that has enabled Wall Street to become wealthier than it ever was, the banks to become more consolidated than they ever were, and having more power than they ever did before. So it's a disconnect, whether we're talking about the Democratic administration right now, between what they overtly say. After all, this Hillary Clinton's husband who signed to eliminate the Glass-Steagall Act that enabled banks to become more powerful.
All right, John, you brought up a lot here, but let me cut to the chase in a sense and go to you, Jerry Garofoli. I mean, the disdain over previous policies, how much is that continuing to play, particularly the policies of the Iraq War and the economic meltdown, which, you know, the Democratic administration kept bringing up, of course, and yet here they are again.
We're going to hear everything. We're going to hear everything about that. We're going to have – I think that's going to – we're going to relitigate the Iraq War. We're going to relitigate what happened on Wall Street, which is that nobody got nailed for what happened there. And these issues are going to continue. And I think it's healthy for the country that they do.
And what about, if I go to you, David, from a lot of people are talking about what's going to happen if Bloomberg enters this race. What do you think?
Well, I find it sort of hard to imagine that he will. It's an idea that is hugely attractive to political consultants who see, you know, in Washington, lobbyists use the term a two-Lexus bill for a really juicy and lucrative piece of legislation. It's ordinary legislation. You buy a Lexus with it, but if you've got a good one, you get two Lexuses. this may be a Ferrari. This is a Ferrari campaign or a Lamborghini campaign that consultancy will never be the same. I don't know that you get to be as successful as Mayor Bloomberg has been without calculating odds very carefully, and I don't see a path for him.
Well, he said he's put aside $1 billion. He's talking as he's got political consultants. He's talking as if he's certainly interested. So we'll have to wait and see. But I'm looking at a Facebook comment here from a listener who writes, Bernie is meeting with Al Sharpton. I'll take a Trump anybody ticket over a Sanders Sharpton ticket any day.
That's a photo op. That's, you know.
You know, I'm more interested that today the very wise, humane writer Ta-Nehisi Coates, someone I think David is a colleague of over at The Atlantic, endorsed Bernie Sanders. Ta-Nehisi is a person of great integrity on racial justice issues. You know, Al Sharpton has many facets to him. He's on MSNBC, as we all know. He does many things. He runs an interesting network, a National Action Network in New York, and he is tied into many of the, you know, African-American establishment in this country. So, but I think Ta-Nehisi Coates' endorsement, I think Ben Jealous, former head of the NAACP.
Cornel West.
Both of those are younger generation. Cornell's not in that same generation. But, you know, Nina Turner, former Secretary
Ohio
of State,
State Senator,
I believe. Yeah, I mean, so I think you have an interesting generational divide. God knows what the establishment means in these times. It's a term that has had a long history. We may be witnessing, David alluded to this, the last gasp of the establishment. But there is an establishment in progressive community and conservative communities. And there's a divide, generational often, in other ways as well.
Well, one of the things that keeps coming up again, and I heard a Hillary Clinton campaign person talk about young people feeling as if Bernie has some kind of magic wand, and that was NPR, it was Ari Shapiro, I believe, who said, you know, you're kind of dissing young people here, assuming. I'm looking actually, apropos of that, at an email from Nancy, David Frum, like to get your responses. I'm all for changes Bernie talks about, but yet to hear how he's going to do this with current Congress. Obama had great goals, and look how he was blocked at every step, even when the idea was acceptable to Republicans.
Yeah, I'll say this for the young people. The message of the Bush and Clinton campaigns often seems to be what you want are the products you hate from the brands you trust. I don't blame people for choosing the unknown, which may be a disaster, over something that is a proven disappointment.
Want to comment here, Joe?
I was about the way Clinton is addressing young people. And she said it last night. She said, here's my message to the young people. In other words, she was almost addressing them. There's a distance there. She's not saying, here's my message to you. I hear you. It was sort of like addressing them almost as a demographic, as a focus group. And she's going to have to overcome that if she's going to have to connect better than speaking to them in that sort of distanced way.
Well, we're obviously going to continue to follow the race as things unfold. South Carolina up ahead, Nevada up ahead. Thanks to Gerald Garofoli, senior political writer for The Chronicle, to Katrina Vandenhuvel of The Nation magazine, editor and publisher, and they have endorsed Senator Sanders, to David Frum, senior editor of The Atlantic and former speechwriter for George W. Bush. You can read his piece, The Great Republican Revolt, in the 2016 January edition of The Atlantic. And thanks also to Matthew Continetti, who joined us earlier, editor of The Washington Free Beacon and contributing editor of The Weekly Standard. Another hour ahead, we're going to talk to Alec Ross about his new book, The Industries of the Future. Stay tuned for that. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.